Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Professor Paul Rodgers, one of the most forward-thinking analysts of our time, unpacks the themes of his book, A Crowded, Glowering World, Path to a Sustainable and Secure Future. Rodgers explores the interconnected challenges we currently face and delivers insights into understanding this global polycrisis. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this crucial conversation is not just an academic discussion, it's a call to action which outlines practical steps towards a more secure and equitable world.
Good afternoon. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I should perhaps explain a little bit about how this particular event came into being. Those of us who have been involved in the Literature Festival for a few years tend to know that sometime around usually January, February, SEMA will give us a call and say what you're doing and what you think we should be doing. It probably goes to about 50 or 100 people. When she rang me, I said, well, about 25 years ago, I wrote a book called Losing Control. And that was all about the possibility of the Western world really not getting the way that international security was going. And there was the risk of basically paramilitary groups and others having a major effect. And I went as far as suggesting, you know, you could get a catastrophic attack on somewhere like New York, and actually specified the World Trade Center, because there had been an attempt on it back in 1993. Anyway, the book was published and rather poorly reviewed generally. And then when 9/11 happened, suddenly the sales took off. And I did a couple more editions over the years. And then I did a final edition, it will be the final one, I'm sure, about 3 years ago. But by then it had grown. And I mean, it was about 90,000, 100,000 words. And it was quite a sort of a big thing. And times were changing a lot. So somebody suggested, well, why don't you try and do a sort of a much more condensed version and bring it up to date at the same time? And this is what I was working on. And the end result is a book which is not going to be published until early September, unfortunately. But Seema said, well, you at least do a talk about it, can't you? I said, oh, I'll do that, certainly. So basically, we've got this talk about a book without a book, if you don't mind. And it's called essentially the Insecurity Trap, a brief guide or a short guide to transition. And what it tries to do is to look at summarizing the main problems as I see them, and quite a few other people see them as well, and what the solutions are. And the time span is over the next sort of 7 to 10 years. It's not immediate. So while there's a huge risk that the likes of Ukraine and Gaza will be continuing, and I'm afraid DRC and Sudan, certainly quite possible, we're looking at a much more broader level. And so that's the aim of the book, to do that. I'll start off with a quote which you may have heard from me before, and it goes right back. It was back at a conference that I was involved in running back at Huddersfield Poly back in 1972. So it's 42 years ago. 52 years ago, yes, 52 years ago. I learned to count. And there was one particular quote by a person who was an economic geographer called Edwin Brooks. And he'd been president of the Conservation Society and actually done 4 years as an MP as well. And he was trying to present the kind of world we were facing, what we needed to do to make it more peaceful, but what would go wrong if it became more of a dystopia. And he summarized this in the risk of a crowded, glowering planet of massive inequalities of wealth buttressed by stark force, yet endlessly threatened by desperate people in the global ghettos. Now, that seemed really doomwash back then, but the real elements of it now, which you can see what he was getting at. And essentially, what I'm trying to do this afternoon is just to look at, unpick that a little bit, unpick what I think are the three main themes, the main challenges we face, see how they've developed, but most crucially, see what one could do to prevent them getting worse. And one of the points about the book is I've tried to do that. I've been able to collaborate with a very experienced person, Judith Large, who's done mediation with societies and the rest all over the world. And she's actually done a really good chapter at the end talking about the practicalities of what people can do, which is also, as it happens, a very good guide to not getting too depressed at what is particularly big problems. I'll try and speak for only half an hour, maybe 35 minutes at most. So we've got at least a quarter of an hour for questions. And we will be having a roving mic. If it's possible to put the lighting on the audience up very slightly, I'd appreciate it, because then it's easy to actually have the sort of the eye contact. That's great. That just makes a difference, believe me, it does. So where do we start? Well, obviously, there are big issues. There is the risk again of slipping into a nuclear crisis, which we wouldn't have said 3 or 4 years ago. There's the risk of pandemics, obviously. We've been through one which probably has killed about 20 to 25 million people worldwide. And obviously, there are issues like AI, remote warfare, and the rest, which are looming very large. But I'd still say that there are really three underlying issues that we faced. One is that we have an increasingly divided planetary system. Wealth poverty is quite extraordinary, almost obscene levels of wealth now being reached. A second is limits to growth, to use the old phrase from the early 1970s, and we are now clearly exceeding the environmental capacity to handle human activity. And the third one, which people talk about rather less, is the tendency to see things in terms of hard security. So if you have a threat, you've got to meet the threat, and that means having powerful militaries to do it. I think there was a phrase which has been used over the years. I think Barack Obama used it, and that was, if the only thing you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So essentially, if you have the means to protect yourself against a threat, then that's how you handle a threat. You don't look sort of underneath at what the problems are in the first place. And I call that lidism. You're keeping the lid on things rather than going to the underlying features. And what we're dealing with require you to actually look more deeply. Let's just take those in turn. I'll start off, which I think myself is the most immediate problem. They're all big problems, but the most immediate one is environmental limits, and I would say particularly climate breakdown. And I think it's much better to use the term climate breakdown than climate change or global warming, because this is a potential breakdown of the global climatic system. You can go right back 50 more years to when this is coming out. In fact, I go farther than that. And there was work done by two quite incredible women, which I think tend to be forgotten a little bit first. One, I'm sure a name you will know, Rachel Carson. And she was a freshwater biologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She wrote a really good bestseller about marine ecology, the open sea. And then she turned her attention in the 50s to the problem of the impact of pesticides on wildlife. And she wrote a book called Silent Spring, published, I think, in about 1961, which put this all together. And the fact that new forms of insecticides, the organophosphate ones in particular, were killing off wildlife, mainly through affecting all sorts of birds of prey, which then behaved very oddly, and in many cases, their eggs broke, they became so fragile. The net effect of this was a worldwide impact, and there was a heavy resistance by the agrochemical companies to any sort of threat, any suggestion that they were causing problems. But she had a lot of support from ecologists at the time, and really it was the start of a concern of a wider environmental movement. We'd had problems in Britain and problems all over the world. I'm just about old enough to remember the Great Smog of London back in 1952, which killed, we now know, probably about 10,000 to 12,000 people. It was reckoned to be fewer at the time. Now we know more about it. And there are other incidents as well. And then the second book was essentially a book by American author. In fact, it was a group. I'll just get the names right here because I think I really need to do this. And one essentially was Rachel Carson. The other was Danella Meadows, who you probably have not heard of. And she was the head of a four-person team at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which wrote this book called Limits to Growth. Came out in 1971 and had a very big impact on the world's first big conference on the human environment, which was in Stockholm in 1972. And essentially what the book was saying was it was a very early systems analysis of the global system, including the environment. It wasn't just about economics and social change. And essentially, there were four people involved, her husband and two others, but she was the key thinker, most people think. Very sadly, she died only about 4 or 5 years after the book was published. It had already had a big impact, but I think over the years, people have seen it as a crucial text, because what it said was, if we continue as we are in terms of the impact on the global environment, we're going to exceed the limits. They didn't say it was going to happen in 2 or 3 or 10, 20 years' time. She was looking about 40 to 50, even 60 years ahead. And the decades she was talking about were the 2020s and the 2030s.
It was called another Doomwatch book. It was basically decried by most people on the economic side who said, there are always ways to deal with this. Technology will work. But the problem is it didn't. And essentially, as you move into the 1970s, you see the beginnings of the impact of these limits. The first phases of the environmental movement was in the 1970s, when people would think about even things like solar panels and wind turbines. That really got overtaken by events. And of course, in 1973, some of you will remember, we had this gigantic increase in oil prices because the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries learned how to handle the markets in a way which previously only the oil companies had been able to do. And so you had something like a 400% increase in the price of oil in the space of 7 or 8 months. And it had a huge impact on the global environment. And one of the things it did towards the end of the 1970s was persuade people who were looking at the economic models in a very different way to come forward. And in fact, at the end of the 1970s, you had a move away from the more conventional Keynesian economic system to what we would call neoliberalism. And that came in very strongly with Thatcher and Reagan in the 1980s and got a huge boost, of course, at the end of the 80s with the collapse of the centrally planned system of the Soviet bloc. But as far as the limits to growth was concerned and the environmental impact, bit by bit, people began to realize that there were multiple limits which we were exceeding. And the one by the 1990s, which was becoming dominant, was the risk of climate breakdown caused by excessive carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere. So essentially, that became probably one of the most important issues behind the scenes, not widely recognized, I think, among people as a whole, but increasingly by the end of the 1990s. You have beginnings of the UN conferences, the Conference of Parties, the COP series, which we have now every year, usually November, December, and those are designed to try and sort of find ways of cutting back on the carbon emissions, mainly carbon dioxide, but of course methane was also important. Now, essentially, we got really somewhere with that, but nowhere near enough, and it's not going fast enough. And the position we are at present is we're actually seeing almost in front of us climate breakdown starting to happen. You just look at the news with that sort of filter on, looking at the climate, and you see every week reports of basically records being broken. I just looked through this morning, and I mean, there have been huge problems in a whole range of countries, mostly at the moment flooding, but with extraordinary temperatures being reached across South and Southeast Asia recently. And, you know, many, many people dying as a result of that. It's not reported anything like the level it should be, but it is clearly happening. That, I think, is having an impact. But we now, I think, are pretty clear, especially the climate scientists are clear, that if we don't get a grip on this within about the next 5 or 6 years, certainly by 2030, then the world is going to become, in climate terms, seriously unstable in many different countries. And we're going to see huge necessary movements of desperate people, migration on a much larger scale at present. In other words, if we don't get in control of it, then we're into very major problems, which is why I think of those three issues I said at the start, environment, economy, and security. I think the environment is the immediate one, although it is made worse in some ways by the impact of the other two. Against that, there are actually some good signs. And I think what is worth saying is just remember three things. One is the knowledge of climate science is hugely better than 30 or 40 years ago. Far better mega computers, far more people working on it, far more data coming in. Which means, for example, that if you actually have a modern day model and apply it to the climate as it was 30 years ago, and see what it would have predicted 30 years ago, because you know what's going to happen next, because we're 30 years down the line, you find these models are becoming uncannily accurate, much more so than even 20, 30 years ago. So in other words, you can predict with pretty good certainty what's going to happen. And the one thing I've noticed personally is many climate scientists working in universities or for governments or for research stations have in the past tended to be rather cautious about being too doom watch, if you like, and saying it's not, you know, it's bad, but you know that we may be wrong. They don't say that now. They're much more blunt because far more climate scientists are really seriously, personally worried. Now that, in one sense, means that at least we know what's going to happen, and there is a change, particularly among younger people, of an awareness of just how serious this could be. But against that, we have quite a revolution going on as well, and that is the revolution in decarbonization. One of our sons is a renewable energy engineer. He lectures down at Nottingham Trent University, and he keeps me up to date. But essentially, what you see is that the technologies are at last changing. You know, you can now get a photovoltaic system for producing your own electricity on your roof at about a third of the cost of 12 years ago. The prices have come right the way down, and the prices of batteries are coming down by leaps and bounds. In other words, in most areas, electricity generated from either wind or solar is cheaper by some measure than electricity generated from coal, certainly coal and oil and even gas. What's called grid parity has been exceeded time and time again. And this is why, you know, any sensible government would have been investing in heavily in this for a very long time. The problem is that there's a very, very powerful lobby system among what we call the fossil carbon industries, both the companies and the producing countries, to act against this. And we know now, for example, that one of the biggest oil companies had its people working on this something like 40, 50 years ago and knew in advance that what it was doing was going to cause havoc in the long term, and instead put more money into trying to say there's no problem. And that, I think, is it's a shocking thing, but that's where we are. But the point is, it can be done now. We can actually decarbonize very rapidly. And I'll come back to this in a little bit. Now, essentially, that, in a sense, I think, is one crucial point. But beyond that, we have the other two issues. And I think it's worth bringing in a way that people don't normally do, the economy side. Now, as I said earlier on, until certainly the late 1970s, early 80s, the Western world, and through its control, the global South as a whole, ran on a more or less Keynesian model. In other words, they tended to be mixed economies. You tended to have some major sectors of economies actually in government hands, in other words, nationalized, and you had others which were basically more free market. The two mixed together. And essentially, that was pretty successful in terms of bringing about growth, about which a little bit more later. But essentially, it was pretty set in its ways. And also, it was actually heavily balanced towards the existing richer states. And this is a feature of the transition from colonialism to post-colonialism. You know, the world economy in the 1950s and 60s was very much controlled by the major resource consumers of the North. In other words, the United States, Britain, France, Germany, and through to Japan and Australia, of course, which for the purpose of this argument is considered to be part of the global North. But the point here is that when you have that kind of system, it is pretty exploitative, and you could say that, you know, in some ways it's a natural development from slavery of the sort of a couple of centuries before. But it is also a mixed economy in a sense that the level of wealth and the differences in wealth in the richer states are at a certain level, but overall, they're not getting wider. And that was certainly true 40, 50, 60 years ago. Now, at the same time, you had in the 1940s and 50s another economic approach, which tends to be called market fundamentalism, or neoliberalism for short. And what that basically said is that, in a sense, if you're basically producing an economy which has a fairly high level of cooperation among it, that is economically inefficient. And what is much more efficient is an economy which is much more competitive. And that, if you like, is the basis of the neoliberal approach. And essentially, it means that, you know, large government, which is running part of your economy, is not a good thing. It is much better to have people intensely competitive. But if they work hard, if they work well, if they have successful businesses, they reap the rewards, and you don't have anything like a graduated taxation system. And essentially, this angle, it was developed by a number of economists, Hayek, I suppose, in particular, Friedman and the rest. The group that was probably crucial was a small society known as the Mont Pelerin Society, which met every year in Mont Pelerin, which is just along the lake from Geneva. That essentially brought together economists, historians, philosophers to really plot out this rather different approach. It got a huge boost, as I said, with the failure of the existing system, with those oil price rises. And so by the end of the 1970s, with the election of Margaret Thatcher in Britain, very strong on this line, even this idea of no such thing as society, and Reagan in the United States. Now, the United States was already rather farther down the road with a sort of a tax system which really benefited the wealthy, and it had far less which was run by basically national or local authorities. Britain was sort of at the other end, rather more Keynesianism. But the point is that in that period, you saw, particularly in the United States and Britain, but in other countries rapidly after that, throughout the 1980s, this move over to the neoliberal system, which meant that you had higher levels of privatization. Many of the key parts of an economy were nationalized, were privatized. You had basically a cutting back in financial regulations. Those of you who remember the Big Bang of 1986, you will find a taxation system which was changed to benefit the more successful. And so essentially, you had other features as well, but these are probably the key ones. Now, one other was probably control of labor relations. This is where you had the major in the wars in the United States and in Britain and other countries on the trades unions. And in fact, over the 10 years or so, trade unionism in Britain shrank by about 50%. So essentially, you had a different system during the 1980s, boosted massively by the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the centrally planned economies, except, of course, with China, which combined it a kind of authoritarian capitalism with a lot of central planning. It mixed the two very thoroughly and, in a sense, have been very successful. But the one problem with all of this is that if you have an issue, a global issue, like climate breakdown, which requires strong governmental and intergovernmental cooperation to prevent it, then that runs directly counter to the idea of the neoliberal system. Because essentially, governments should not be playing around with this. This is a problem for the market, and the market will satisfy it. Now, you could claim that in one sense, or maybe the market does, when people realize that electricity from solar or wind is cheaper, they go over to that. And there's some truth in that, but it's far too late. Essentially, this is the real problem. With something like climate breakdown, you have to be acting ahead of the game the whole time. And that is one area where we've not been successful in doing it. Now, the end result here is that if you put the two together, you have an environmentally limited world and one which is highly divided. And one of the other impacts of the neoliberal system, now that it's heading towards its fifth decade, is you're seeing quite extraordinary levels of disparities of wealth, far larger than you've seen since Victorian times. So if you look at the world system, basically very high levels of inequality through to about the 1920s, a dip over a number of years, about 30, 40 years, in which there was slightly less inequality. I won't say more equality, but less inequality. And then in the last 40 years, the inequality element has gone back up. There are many expressions of this. We're well past obscene levels of wealth. You know, we've been talking in this election, there's been talk about, governments are going to need to raise 30, 40, even 50 or 60 billion pounds. It's a Freudian slip there, pounds. And essentially, this is crazy. The richest five people in Britain currently control nearly £200 billion. The richest 1,000 control nearly £1 trillion. And that's just in Britain. It's extraordinary changes. And one of the sort of major illustrations of this was that during the COVID pandemic, when you had wild stock markets in many parts of the world, particularly between April and July of 2021, you had huge concentration of wealth in the people who already had it at an astonishing level. In fact, the world's billionaires, about 2,000 of them at the time, increased their wealth by over 20% in 3 months. And this is because the system allows you to do it. So while you could say, yes, neoliberalism has been very successful, you got all this growth and the rest, it's been a disaster in terms of economic justice. It really has. Now, that, if you like, is the second thing. I'll go fairly quickly through the third one, and that is the whole business of seeing things under control. And I think, to put it without going into details of military-industrial complexes, which exist in countries right across the world, I have to say, the tendency is to focus very much on really hard security. Where there are major problems, where, if you like, there are revolts from the margins, then you may have to use force at a very early stage. And of course, we do have the means to do this. And when I say we, it's not just Britain, it's any major country with armed forces and its own defense industries. And I'm so eager for, you know, Britain, the United States, China, Japan, Russia, certainly India, and many others, you know, sort of 20 or so countries with big military industrial complexes that in some ways fairly closed systems. They are, I'm afraid, male dominated throughout. And essentially, you also find a sort of cultural attitude in which the defense of the country comes first, and it's defense of the country. I've been very lucky in my career. I've been able to lecture at some of the major defense colleges, you know, on a regular yearly basis or so, for the past 40 years or so. And if you sort of discuss this sort of theme with the military and say, well, you know, essentially, you are going to get a situation that you can't control. You know, we have problems with migration now. If you're getting tens of millions of desperate people needing to cross borders, how do you control it? You control it, they will say, well, we'll put the barriers up. But I say you can't control it because people get so angry that you end up with an uncontrollable, insecure world. And the thing is that you say this and you get some very sensible conversations as seen in military, but they point out their job is to defend the realm. It's the job of politicians to look at the longer term threats and act accordingly. Now, there are some senior military who do not hold this. There's Rear Admiral Morissetti, who was, in fact, an advisor to the government, and he took the view, is still active, I should say, that, in fact, climate change is the biggest single threat. But they're fairly far, few and far between, I'm afraid. And the point about this is that it's a further factor in that you have very powerful industries, and they are powerful with incredibly good lobbyists, who say you've got to spend your money on conventional defense. And we have the extraordinary situation. This is Armed Forces Day today. And catching the news this morning, there was Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer going to places with military connections, saying they're going to spend the money and they're going to increase defense spending. Sorry, I should say military spending by such an amount. In fact, it's directly against what we should be doing. That's sort of sketching the problem as a whole. But what I'm trying to do in the book, and what Judith is doing, particularly in her section at the end, where she's looking at individual actions, is to look much more positively. And the point about this is there's been some very good work, obviously on environmental issues. I should say there are all kinds of developments rethinking economics. New Economics Foundation, you know, the donut model, recycling and the rest. A lot more could and is being done, but it could be speeded up. But on the military side, there's also some very good work going on. If you're not familiar with it, then just Google Rethinking Security. It's a very interesting group of people, mixture of mediators, academics, and some activists who are basically trying to work out what sort of security policy should a country like Britain have. And there are other groups in other countries doing the same way. And as a matter of interest, they very recently did some sort of rather detailed service work, survey where they did a series of opinion surveys using Savanta, which is one of the very big survey companies. And I might say the money for this came from a Quaker trust. Quakers are very heavily involved in a lot of this. And essentially, they were asking people, it's split into two groups, I think it was 16 to 31 years old, and 31 to 65 were the major groups they looked at. And essentially, what they tried to do was to ask people what they were concerned about when it came to their own security. But this was not the sort of security review which said, you know, should we be spending more on defense? Should we be spending more on this? Should we have more nuclear weapons than the rest? It doesn't sort of, by the questions, dictate how they answer. And if you get much more open-ended questions, well, this is the kind of thing that you get. Among 16 to 30, what, here we are. This is what they actually say. Responses to the survey suggest that members of the general public think very differently about their own security and that of the UK when allowed to shape their own definitions. Unprompted, they are much more likely to be concerned about their own well-being and socioeconomic conditions than about external threats. They are also ambivalent and often deeply skeptical of the protection normally provided to them by the British state. I say this is a national survey, and among 16 to 30-year-olds, 74% of them rated corruption, and 68% rated the actions of their own governments as significant threats to national security. And the report adds other leading issues were actually climate change, pandemics, and the economy. So this is, it's a rare bit of work. It's only published, in fact, it's only published last week, which actually presents a very different picture. So on the basis of that, and since we are getting fairly close to what I gather is a general election, which we're going to have a few days' time, what sort of policies should there be in an election manifesto to address these issues? What would you see? And essentially, you can sketch it out. And going back on the climate side, then I think it was about 4 years ago in 2020, the UN Climate Committee made an estimate of what it would be required to do to prevent global average temperatures exceeding 1.5 degrees centigrade. By common agreement among climate scientists, once you get beyond that, then you get into really troubled waters. We've already gone up by about 1.2, maybe 1.3% compared with industrial time, early industrial times. But essentially, if we go much higher, then it's going to get extremely dangerous very quickly. Now, essentially, what they reckon in 2020 was you needed to curb carbon dioxide emissions by 7% per year for a decade. Now, that's, as you know, reverse compound interest. So it doesn't take you, it's not sort of 7 by 10, et cetera. But essentially, it will bring carbon emissions down to about 40% of the current levels. So it wouldn't be net zero. If you could do that, they said, by 2030, because this was done in 2020, then we would almost certainly not exceed 1.5 degrees. The problem is that over the last 4 years of those 10 years, every year has seen an increase in carbon dioxide emissions, not a decrease. It's possible that this year it might plateau for the first time, which is extremely good news, but just to start. But this means that essentially we have to do this far more rapidly. Now, if you were going for an aim for a country, just pure by coincidence, say Britain. Well, Britain actually is extremely well positioned to do that, given the political will. Because we do have a huge unused capacity for renewables, in spite of what is already happening. By one of those coincidences, we have another son who's a marine maritime engineer, and he works on navigation risks of new facilities, new harbors, and the rest. And much of their work currently is actually assessing navigation risk of new offshore wind farms. And I was talking to him fairly recently, and apparently you're now getting systems which are quite astonishingly efficient if you can have those floating and far offshore. Now, just as an example, fairly near where I live, south of Huddersfield, we have one of the first ever wind farms in Britain. It's the Royds-Moor farm, you may know it, it's near Ingbirchworth, and that farm is still running. I think it got started put it this way, it's about 24, 25 years, maybe 26 years old. And essentially, it is still running. Most of the turbines are working most of the time. And it has 13 turbines, each which gives you about 2/3 of a megawatt of electricity. So that's a total of about 9 megawatts for the entire wind farm. A single offshore turbine now will give you 10 megawatts. And they're now developing floating turbines, which are 15 megawatts. Now, what that means is an array spread over, you know, not that many square miles will produce as much electricity as a full-fledged 1 gigawatt nuclear reactor, at a fraction of the price of that nuclear reactor, I should say. And it can be made and built within 2 or 3 years from scratch. And that is what is already starting to happen. And Ed was reckoning that you're going to see more and more of these. And these are very large, deep offshore. And the key thing about that is the more you get into the open ocean, the more regular the wind becomes and more predictable. So you reap a huge reward from that. And that's an example where, again, government coordinated action, working with industry, can achieve extraordinary changes. The easiest way to drop our carbon emissions and the cheapest is probably proper home insulation. A national campaign of emergency aid to people to produce more efficient houses by simple things like loft insulation everywhere would have a very big effect within 3 or 4 years. The transition to electric vehicles and the rest could be much faster than it is. Right across the board, you can do it much quicker. We know how to do it. It's the political will and the public support which is missing, but it can be done. So basically, you would have a manifesto which says this in detail, that if we are elected, we are going to do this. Now, to be fair, the Greens come fairly close to this. And they're a bit cautious in what they say, but they're saying this kind of thing. But where we get the differences is the second area: how are we going to face up to the whole problem of the neoliberal system, which is not working, it's not delivering justice. But here again, even in the space of one parliament, you can make some changes. For a start, there's a huge capacity to go for tax avoidance and tax evasion, and the whole business of the tax havens. Much more could be done than that. In fact, the tendency of governments in recent years has been cut down the size of inland revenue and not go for the really big people. And essentially, that could change, and change quickly. You could then have a different taxation system, which means that, you know, there's virtually no tax for people earning very little, and sort of very low threshold, a very fair threshold, but more progressively for people who are sort of bringing in 50, 60, 80, 100,000, and much more for people who are getting 200,000 or 300,000 or even a million a year. And there are quite a few people doing that. But in other words, you get a fairer tax system. And essentially, it means that the broader shoulders bear the bigger burden. There are many other things you can do. Certainly, if you look at the way in which some of the privatized industries have been behaving, then it is quite extraordinary. And certainly, there are very strong arguments for renationalizing a number of them, starting with water companies and starting with a whole range of energy utilities. Here again, the system has not worked as expected. You get more and more concentrated wealth in relatively few hands. But when I say relatively few, I'm not talking about hundreds. I'm talking about maybe sort of several hundred thousand people are doing much better than the rest. And essentially, that has to change. You have a government which is prepared to do that. I would go further myself. I know this is more of a personal view. On the military side, I would actually like to see cuts in defense spending, not increasing. Myself, and I know it may be a bit of a lone voice in this, I cannot see any reason at all why Britain should be a nuclear power. I really can't. We have the capacity with our Trident system to kill about 120, kill 20 people in about 120 minutes. That's what we could do. Is that really the sign of a civilized country? There are only 8 other countries that have nuclear weapons. 9 countries out of what is 190. Yet essentially, it seems to me it's much more, it's a delusion of post-imperial grandeur, and it gets us a seat on the Security Council. But to my mind, it's a false thing, and we shouldn't be involved in it. But beyond that, I would contrast the way in which this particular government, it was one when Johnson was in power, actually cut the international development budget by $4 billion, the same time as he increased the defense budget by a similar amount. Now, to my mind, that should be reversed. It should go back the other way. But also, I would like to see us aim not just to get to the 0.7% of the UN sort of plan for the amount of GDP equivalent that you use in international development. I'd like to see it to get to 1%. But the point is, what you're going to need here is for countries right across the world, across the global south, to be able to transition much quicker to basically low-carbon systems. And in some ways, you leapfrog much of the industrial period. And that, again, is possible to do. You look at the huge capacity right across Africa for solar power. Quite astonishing. And time after time, it's possible to do it. And countries, the poorest countries, need relatively little aid to make a very big difference. And that seems to me, again, a much more relevant thing in terms of global security. I'm not saying you don't have defensive systems. I don't believe that's possible. But essentially, what you can do is reorientate it what you think security really means and go for that. Now, how are we doing for time? Now, I'm going to have to bring this to an end now because we must have time for discussion. What I'm trying to do, and what the book will try to do, particularly with Judith's help, is apply this to what ordinary people can do, because it is very easy to get extremely depressed when you look at the seriousness of it. There's a very good outlet you want to check out. It's called Carbon Brief. Just check out Carbon Brief. It's basically a think tank which records what's actually happening. They've used a very good summary every Friday afternoon. You have a quick read, it brings you up to date, so Carbon Brief. But what I would say, in a sense, is that we are in a position where we have these three issues which interact and work against producing a fair and more secure world. But it is not too late to change that, and it's going to be essential to change that. Now, the question back is, well, do I, somebody who's sort of worked on this for a number of years, really think that's possible? Yes, I do. It is possible. We are certainly going to come to terms with climate breakdown, Either we do it sensibly soon, or we do it in a disastrous way when millions of people have already been killed. It's going to change. So what we need to do is to change it in time. Well, if I could offer one definition of prophecy, and that is prophecy is suggesting the possible. In other words, you're saying this is what can be done, given the political will and the will of ordinary people to do it. Can it happen? Well, I certainly hope it can happen. You know, like many people, we've got grandchildren. We've got two grandchildren who are just barely a year old. And they will be alive, inshallah, God willing, in the 22nd century. And certainly, they have got to be protected, even if some of us here are perhaps not going to last another 10 years, let alone another 40 years. But the point about this, again, is you can make the changes. And whether we can do it is going to depend a lot on us, any of us, all of us, in small ways, making a tiny contribution. And recognizing the more people work together, the more you have an impact. Any one person can do a tiny bit and can get very depressed about it. There are many, many other people doing other tiny bits. It adds up very much. So in a sense, there is cause for optimism, but there's cause for realism as well. So what I've tried to do is to suggest ways forward. All I've tried to do with probably Judith as well is to do this in a small book. The whole book is only about 20,000 words, about a fifth of the size of a normal book. I gather these things are becoming quite popular now, which is nice. So if you're interested in that, I wish I had some copies. I've got a few postcards which illustrate what's in it. By all means, take one at the end if you wish. But if you're interested in this, then the publisher is Hawthorne Press. Just Google Hawthorne Press and you get all the details. And I think they're hoping to get advanced copies ready in early to mid-August. So it will be available. And I hope you find it useful and maybe spread the word. What we've also done, importantly, is given a list of a number of books. I think none of them are seriously technical stuff in the environment, the economic and security side as well, which you can use as well. Many of you will know a lot of them already, but it gives you a further list. Let's leave it at that point. Sorry, I've done it again. I've gone too far. Could we have the lights up, please? And I'll just open it. Any questions? We've got 15 minutes anyway for questions. So who would like to ask the first question?
Right. Okay. Paul, thank you so much. Very concise, as usual. My gut feeling is to agree with you about hard security. But in the light of the fact that apparently Russia's spending 40% of their income on defense, some people see a parallel between their invasion of Ukraine and Hitler's invasion of Czechoslovakia, and it should be resisted at all costs with hard force. So what would you say to that?
I think that the situation in Ukraine is straightforward. Russia's spending about 40% of its state budget, not its income, the state budget. In other words, 40% of spending is going on that at present, they reckon. Well, in Ukraine, and you would also say Gaza in different ways, the reality is that both of those conflicts are stagnated, they're stalemated, and neither side can win. Russia can't win in Ukraine, because the more it puts effort into trying to beat Ukraine, the more NATO will come in, because NATO has too much to lose. NATO can't win, because if basically the Ukrainians are given the help to sort of defeat Russia, the thing will go chemical or nuclear. So this is a conflict which has to be ended at the table. Why are the Russians doing it? It's complicated. And I hate to say that in one bit, Farage has slight elements of truth in it. And essentially, because obviously, when the Soviet system collapsed in 1989, 1990, Russia was treated with contempt by the Western world. You know, the poverty rate in Russia went up to, what was it, 50 million out of 150 million people in deep poverty. And it was a heck of a struggle. And essentially, Russians over 50 remember that very, very well. They're very bitter about it as well. I mean, look at us in Britain. We basically lost our empire over about 40 years between the time of Gandhi and really sort of the 1970s, 1980s. Russia lost its empire in about 40 weeks. We've finished losing our empire 40 years ago. We still haven't got over it now. So essentially, you can understand that Putin has been incredibly successful in using that to say Russia must be rebuilt. We're in an extremely difficult position. Yes, you provide, you help Ukraine defend itself, however you think best to do that. But you've also got to say, this has to be ended at the negotiating table. And essentially, there's so much money being made out of this war that it's difficult to do that. You actually look at the changes in the share prices of the world's major arms companies in the first 3 months of the Ukraine war, and then look at what happened in the first month of the Gaza war. And they're very good indicators of who makes the money out of these things. It's not a complete answer, but at least I think it throws a complexion on it, which people are all too easy, ready to forget.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to question what your position is in terms of the philosophy. Like today, we're living in a postmodern society, and we've gone through the period of positivism and enlightenment, and now in a position where science is seen as the dominant philosophy informing our understanding of the world. We've only have to look at COVID-19 to see how science has been dominating policy processes, shaping society. Do you think we need another period of enlightenment that questions science?
I'm sorry, it's partly my own hearing, but I'm having a little bit...
Yeah, so...
Sorry about that.
Yeah, so if you take... Foucault was saying that this, we have a parallel situation. We're in an era that is parallel to the period of enlightenment. Yeah. So during the period of enlightenment, you know, God, biblical beliefs, ideas was all superseded by science, and science overtook, you know, common ideas, philosophies. So Foucault was arguing that we are now in a period where science has become the new God, and we need a postmodern move to question science. Yeah. So do you think we need to move towards a society where we question the value of nature, and that nature should be fundamental in informing decision-making processes? Because that is part of the economy. Because if we have no world, we have no economy. So if you take neoliberalism or you take monetarism, and that's a founding principle, does that not need to be replaced with an economic policy that is governed by the limits and fruits of nature?
It's very difficult to say. You know, I find it's a very difficult question to answer, frankly. Sorry, I can't hear. No. I'm sorry about this.
We don't have an economic policy that incorporates nature into the equation. But obviously, if there is no nature, there is no world, there is no economy. So surely nature ought to be incorporated into economic policies.
Yes. Yeah. I'm still not sure, I'm afraid. It's not an easy one to answer. You know, it could more or less go in different directions. Sorry, I've got problems with that.
So largely what I'm saying is we don't have an economic policy that incorporates or sees nature or the world as an asset, when actually the world is our asset. So, for example, if you want a wind farm to produce energy or oil, without the wind or the world, we can't produce that. So we have to start seeing the world as an asset.
Well, I certainly see that. And yes, I mean, I accept that, but I'm still not certain about how you approach it, frankly.
Hi. I might be asking the question in a slightly different way that lady's just done, but it might add to it. I'm going to take the premise of my question as being that the powerful companies, military and industrial complex, etc., are systems that are designed to maintain themselves in wealth and wealth disparity. And my question is, what will it take for those who have the power, the money, lobbying power, to flip, for them to see their own existential threat to their business and their ability to maintain their system of wealth divide and wealth disparity? What will it take to flip that over?
That I don't know, because the problem is that where you see the early signs of people recognizing the problems, then you actually find that they all sort of button themselves up and protect themselves. In other words, they see this as a threat to themselves, and rather than something which requires real foresight. There are some exceptions. You know, one of the world's biggest engineering companies, Siemens, decided about 15 or 20 years ago that essentially green energy was going to be essential, and that was where they were to develop. The entire company did this. But if you take the example, frankly, of the oil and gas companies, and their knowing what was going to happen, having the scientific support for it, and then working against it happening, because it would affect their profits, frankly, it's got to come from pressure from other people. You will get individuals who will recognize this, and you will get some people with sort of modest wealth who actually try and work out how to do this. And there are groups in Britain, the groups elsewhere who do that. But essentially, the pressure has to come from ordinary people. And so that's the essentially, it's got to come to some extent through the democratic process. And it would be lovely to think that everybody's like St. Paul, have a conversion on the road to Damascus. Some will, and that is very welcome. And you do get some of the big foundations that are really changing their policies. But I'm afraid we're going to have to wait quite a long time for the most wealthy, most powerful people to do this. That's the reality, I'm afraid.
I think most people in the audience will agree with you that we need to tax the people with the most wealth. But right-wing people say you can't do that because they'll simply move elsewhere. Is that true? And what can we do about it?
Well, the best paper to read on this is a Saturday edition of the Financial Times, which I've taken for quite a long time, because it tracks this kind of thing. Some people will, without question. But this is where one of the things that is likely to happen is that if you have one or two countries deciding to do this, others will follow. Other electorates will see the value of this. In other words, there won't be too many places for people to go to live with their wealth. Now, okay, it's fair enough. There's been a lot of movement from Russian oligarchs through to Dubai in the last year or so, at the risk of even a very mildly economically changing government that we might get with Mr. Starmer. But the central thing is, not many people will do so. And the numbers are probably not likely to be hugely significant. But what is more important is this is best done where you get countries working together on it. There has to be an acceptance. This is a common problem worldwide. And yes, you get some countries that power ahead. And those countries that do it may be the countries which also have a huge sort of potential wealth to generate from renewables. And of course, Britain is in that position. But essentially, there's a risk. I think it's a small one. The indications are that it's pretty small, but it is there, usually for people with extreme wealth, who basically will be living in four or five different countries at the present anyway. They'll probably keep their ones here, but basically they'll move the systems. And that is where you have to have the international cooperation. And there were many people arguing within the EU 5 or 6 years ago that this is exactly the kind of thing that a common system like the EU should design itself to do. To put it across a whole number of countries. I think this is going to have to be the last one, I'm afraid.
Talking about what the last lady talked about, I would have thought under a neoliberal system, for example, you've got to put a price on nature, on the ecology, and that would get people, like you really wealthy people, to be involved in it, to invest in it.
Yes. I mean, I think that is one of the approaches to use, and a valid one. But again, the problem I have with when you're trying to price something like that, there's a tendency among economists to price it in a way which is the way they traditionally think, rather than sort of a way which makes sense in relation to what impact it would have. You see what I'm getting at? So yes, but cautiously, any kind of system like that will be helpful. I think we're going to have... We are up for time. I think I should apologize for one thing. I'm the same age, as it happens, as Joe Biden. And I do have a problem with hearing when we're using PA systems. I'm sorry about that, but that's just a factor of age as it develops. But apart from that, thank you very much for coming this afternoon.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.